We are back on Box Office Battles with Greg and Eric. We have a special double episode tonight because, well, I'll tell you why in just a few minutes, but we're going to do both the final four tonight as well as the previous one. So as well as the last of the first round, I guess I should say. With me is Eric. How you doing, buddy?
I am hanging in there, Greg. Welcome, everybody, to the only show in America with the courage to have one grown man explain movies to another grown man.
That is true.
It's a dynamic that we live and die by here at Box Office Battles, and I enjoy it very much.
That is
what
true.
What I'm not enjoying, Greg, is the third round.
Yes.
Oh, God, will you stop playing?
All right, I was trying something new, and
I love it.
It didn't work out the way I planned. I have all kinds of technical difficulties here. It's great.
Listen, if one intro is good,
yes,
just think about how good two intros are. And that's, you know, and that also, Greg, takes a lot of courage.
Yes.
I'm also in a courageous battle with my third round of kidney stones.
Yes.
Well, about every 10 to 12 years. Starting when I was 22, 23, and then again when I was 35-ish, and then now I'm in my late 40s and another round. So my apologies for having to miss or to reschedule from last week. Would not have been a good time to try to do this.
I bet.
Before the Dilaudid, definitely wouldn't have been a good time. After the Dilaudid, would have been a good time, but there is really no telling what I would have said. And there's still no telling. A heavy dose of codeine this evening, but I think everything's going to be fine. Greg, we are, as you said, going to go over the last two films.
Yes.
In our David Lynch Battle of Eight.
Exactly.
And we are going to then push right on through to the other side, as the doors say, and do our final four and crown a winner. We are doing that for one very specific reason. We are on a time crunch. Would you like to tell us the nature of that time crunch?
Well, definitely. Yeah, what has happened is I was notified by my son and my wife last night that they are going to induce my daughter-in-law next week, next Wednesday. So we are hitting the road on Sunday to go to North Dakota to be available for our first grandchild's birth. And that comes first. So I had to jumble a lot of things around. Yeah. And so it's just, you know, it's the way it works. And so we decided to make this one a double episode. But yeah, it just kind of the way things work out with you with the kidney stones. I was like, I didn't want to say that out on the Facebook page. I figured you can fully explain it to yourself.
I appreciate your adherence to strict HIPAA policy that we also follow here at Box Office Battles. Our HR department would not want you telling everybody my medical business unnecessarily. So appreciate that from you. Yeah, man, these kids and these grandkids, freaking inconvenient, dude. And it's just going to stay that way forever. But I hope you have a good trip. How long is the drive from where you're at? You're kind of Columbus area, right?
Yeah.
And so how long is it going to take you to get from your place to where the fuck ever, North Dakota?
The way it looks as we have to go up through Illinois and then Wisconsin, Minnesota, that way is the prime route. And it looks like 17 and a half hours. So I know, right? We're taking our dogs with us. So we are driving in the truck. We're going to do about 10 hours one day, stay somewhere overnight, and then make the 7.5-8 hour journey the rest of the way and get there on Monday night.
I'm no professional geographist, But I could have swore you were going to tell me it was like a 5-hour drive
from here to North Dakota.
I mean, I'm not looking at a map or anything, so I don't know. But
yeah, no,
17
it's,
hours.
He is up near the Canadian border, is where they're stationed at in Minot, North Dakota. So yeah, I'm not adhering to OPSEC rules right now. I'm telling my son's location, but he'd probably freak out if he were watching. But yeah, so I'm looking forward to it. It is a big event, so yeah. we're gonna make it work. I'm gonna edit this, put it out, and then just so everybody knows that's watching, this is also our season finale of season one. So we are going to take a break while I am in North Dakota, you know, welcoming my first grandchild, and then retooling the show for a good start to season two. We want season two to be the best, so we're gonna improve some things in the show. I think the first season has been great. But just like everything, it's the first, so we're getting our feet wet, we're getting used to things, and I think there's a lot better to come. So we're looking at a target of returning for season two end of May, hopefully as soon as that, and we'll keep you all posted. We are going to have our very first season premiere of season two episode is going to be Guilty Pleasures, and we'll talk about that a little bit more in the show. But this is our season finale, episode 20, episode 21, which is about what a regular TV show does, like 22 episodes. So, you know, we're good. So we're going
to
finish this up.
That's the way they used to do it, but now it's just like, here's 7 episodes, and now wait 3.5 years for the next 8 episodes. I'm sick of this shit.
That's the truth. I mean, they get away with that in England. That's how England does shit, and nothing moves. It's like, yeah, it's so... Like watching White Lotus, it's like 8 episodes, and then you got to wait a whole freaking year. Game of Thrones, tired of it.
Supposed to watch this White Lotus thing?
I just started it. You don't have to watch it. Everybody's watching it, so you know FOMO. You're gonna miss out if you don't. You have nobody to talk.
I'm the only person I know that didn't watch this Tiger King back when COVID first kicked off, and now I feel like it's like too late, right? Because I would just watch it and want to talk about it, but nobody wants to talk about Tiger King anymore. Dude, they want to talk about White Lotus.
If you walked into a bar or anything, like, hey, so Tiger King, huh?
Yeah, right? I mean, this guy, what's his name? Johnny Tiger Man or whatever. I don't fucking know, but be like, yeah, this Johnny Tiger Man, huh? He's something else.
What's up with that guy?
He's in prison, right? Or something. I don't
know. He's in prison.
Does he go to prison in the show?
Yes.
Is that what we're here to talk about?
There's two seasons. So, yeah. No, we're not here to talk about Tiger King. But we were talking about how long of the new seasons of TVs are. Yeah. So, TV seasons. So, yeah, we're doing 21. And then we're done with the first season of Box Office Battles. I think it's gone really well. I'm looking forward to season two and what we got, you know, going on. Mike Florida said he was literally finishing the last episode of White Lotus as his stream started. Intense. All right, no spoilers. I'm on episode 4 of the newest season. I just started watching it like 2-3 weeks ago because people were telling me and people I work with was you got to watch it, and I got engrossed right away. I will say that first two seasons are excellent. Third season, I'm kind of like, oh, it's pretty good, but I loved the first two seasons. It was very intense and it's just good writing. So I recommend.
I've read about some pacing issues with season 3. Obviously, I don't have any firsthand knowledge of that. And apparently this Walter Goggins is some phenomenal actor. I know him from Righteous Gemstones.
Mm-hmm. Baby Billy.
Apparently show a scene stealer in White Lotus. So maybe I'll check it out. Maybe I won't. I probably won't. Let's be honest.
You would probably like it. It's a lot to like. It's engrossing. It's a good mystery. Really good writing. Walton Goggins is definitely in the third season. I remember Walton Goggins. I started seeing him in this TV show Justified with Timothy Oliphant back in the day. He played like the main villain, Boyd Crowder, and he was awesome. And I'm like, who is this guy? You know, never seen him before. And yeah, he's good in this new season. I like about like the previous seasons of White Lotus. I liked the most of the stories because there's multiple storylines going on at the same time. This season, I kind of like 2 of the 4 storylines that are going on. I'm not about the Southern family from North Carolina. They're annoying to me. So I'm in episode 4. I'm not really digging that. I'm not loving the actress and her friends. So just for those who watch
no
it.
No offense to our listeners from South Carolina. We love you.
No, it's I like North Carolina and I have no problem with it. I don't like the way they're being portrayed. Just the accents are a little off. The storyline's blah, at least right now. I know spoiler what happens later, but I still just don't like them. So it is what it is. Well, so anybody who likes White Lotus, you know what I'm talking about.
I hate it. Why don't we get into...
Let's do that. First, let's look at the where we're at this bracket. So we've gotten three of the final four set up of David Lynch's best films. So we have been putting these head to head in this bracket for a few weeks now. We've enjoyed some we haven't enjoyed. And our final four is our number one seed, which is The Elephant Man, our number three seed, which was Mulholland Drive, and our number five seed, Lost Highway. And tonight we are going to decide between the remaining two movies that we have in the group, and that is the number two seed, The Straight Story, all done by IMDb rating, and the number seven seed, which is considered like his kind of introduction into film, one of his first films, Eraserhead. So we're going to dig into both of these. We're going to start with, like we always do, with the lower seed, and that would be Eraserhead. And when you saw this, all right, so when we're getting into Eraserhead, You all you did was text me and you said something to the effect of, I just finished Eraserhead. That's all I have to say about it. That was it. That's it.
Okay. I'm still not sure what I have to say about it. I do have one question for you about Eraserhead, though.
Yes.
Because, okay, you know, this is kind of like typically how this thing works is I don't understand something. You are patient and thoughtful with me. So my question is, what the fuck, dude?
All right. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So, I mean, answer that.
Exactly. So I want to take you back in time. I think I've told the story that when I was in high school, we had a shopping mall that we hung out at, and people like to smoke a doobie. Not me. I never did that stuff.
But, no, sure.
But the other people did. They liked to smoke weed before they went into the movie theater. And what was really cool was we had midnight showings on the weekends, and it was all cult films. All right. So the animated film Heavy Metal, Pink Floyd's The Wall, Rocky Horror Picture Show. You get the idea. Monty Python and the Holy Grail. And one of the weekends, somebody, because we rotated, we were like, what did we watch last week? Oh, we watched Rocky Horror. Let's watch The Wall this week. So my friends and I went up there, and Eraserhead had been out for years, and we none of us really knew it, but it was on the list. Saw the poster. And we were kind of like, well, you know, how bad could it be? You know, it's in this list of all these cult films.
And obviously at this time, you don't know who David Lynch is.
No, not at all. It was 84, 85, maybe, you know, maybe, yeah. You know. So we go in there, and it was one of the smaller theaters. I remember that. It wasn't like one of the big ones where you had a lot of seating. So it was just a smaller screen, like today, what you would have in your living room, basically. But anyway, that film came on, and a couple of the guys just got up and left about halfway through. And I was horrified at Eraserhead. It was one of the, and it's not a horror film per se, but it's terrifying.
It's unsettling.
Yeah.
It's like theater of the macabre. It's fucking weird, dude. And I don't mean like, I mean, you can follow this story kind of, you know, we're in some like post-industrial wasteland. Yep. All right. You tell me where I like start losing the plot here, but
no, you're good.
You know, we've got a guy who's kind of like schmutzy and just kind of like doing his fucking thing. And it seems to me like maybe he's got some confidence issues, like some backbone. And so he's in this weird relationship girl with a girlfriend. And like, that was a lot of the first part of the movie, like about 30 minutes of it, I was going, well, this isn't so weird. I mean, it's kind of like weird, but it's not like weird. Well, then the girlfriend's mom tries to sex him. And from that point on, the next hour was just one weird fucking thing after another that I didn't understand.
Oh, yeah.
Didn't get. And I have read, Greg, I have tried to, you know, figure out what this is all about. Paternal instincts is a theme that arises in some of this and some other stuff. Man, if I hadn't read it, I wouldn't see it because I was too.
Yeah,
because I was too busy being so weirded out by everything. And I mean, you can go through the next 1,000 examples of like dumb, weird shit that happens in this movie.
Yeah.
It's been like a couple of weeks, and I've had a tough couple of weeks.
And you're on Cody.
And emotionally. But like, he gets served dinner and they want him to carve like this bird.
Yes.
But he does. And then like stuff starts like
blood. Black. Yeah, it's blood because it's black and white, so you can't see that it's blood. But yeah, there's the picture right on the screen. It starts pouring out of the hole.
That's when I went, okay, like there's this whole genre of like just things that are supposed to be unsettling to you.
Yeah.
This like theater of the absurd and weird and like microwaving a Barbie doll and watching it doesn't mean anything. It's just meant to make you feel that unsettled, weird feeling.
There's so much.
Ooh.
The puppy feeding her pups in there, and it's just a weird suckling noises, and he's staring at it. The way that the girlfriend acts is she's hyper, you know, flittering around. I kind of enjoyed the catatonic grandmother in the kitchen sitting there, and she puts the salad bowl in her lap and then actually helps her grandmother or her mother to toss the salad and then puts a cigarette in her mouth, lights it, and just leaves it there. There's so many things. And that's just the beginning. It gets much weirder than that. This is, I think, the first part is where there's mostly there's the most dialogue. The rest of it after this opening scene, the dialogue goes on to just about minimal. So let's get this clip out of the way. I do want to give an example of what it's like. And this is where the main character, Eraserhead, comes to see his girlfriend's family. And he's talking with the mother who is grilling him on their couch. So let's take a look at this clip from Eraserhead.
I'm a printer.
He's very clever at printing.
Yes, he sounds very clever.
There's the puppies. Her father.
I thought I heard a stranger. We've got chicken tonight. Strangest damn things. They're man-made. Little damn things. Smaller than my fist. But they're new.
They're new. That sums it up pretty much in a nutshell. Right when the clip starts, the girl's having like an epileptic fit and her mother or seizure, and her mother's brushing her hair to get rid of it. And that to me is what's unsettling. And then if you notice the sound of the suckling in the background and the eerie, I can't really call it a soundtrack. It's like something out of Night of the Living Dead, that just this high pitched wail that goes on in the background for much of the film. And it creates this atmosphere of being a horror film, and the fact that it's in black and white. So when you ask me, you know, what the fuck about this movie, I would love to be able to tell you what I think about it. But, you know, I watched it back the first time in the 80s when I was a teenager, and my friends were stoned. I wasn't, but my friends were.
Yeah.
So it had an effect on me. So now when I watch it now, it's one of those things where I put it on and I didn't even try. This one, unlike all the other Lynch films we watched, I just didn't have the energy. It was like, you know, I'm just going to let this play out. I'm not going to look anything up. I'm just going to see what I think. And yeah, I noticed right away, you know, the girlfriend's pregnant. She's had a baby. It's at the hospital. They get married, move in together. They bring home the baby, and it's a monster. It's
a monster.
It's a monster. It's a freak. But I love it. It's an adorable little monster, I thought.
I went into this one like I did all of them, because the reputation that precedes Lynch for a lot of people is that the movies are confusing.
Right.
And we have watched a couple of those where timelines start to become fuzzy, or even the characters that you're seeing just aren't what they seem. And so from that viewpoint, you know, a lot of these films are confusing. This one's not confusing for those reasons, because for a movie this weird, the story is straightforward. I can tell you the story way better than I could tell you the story of Lost Highway.
Gotcha.
You know, yeah. You know, or explaining to someone who's never seen it, Mulholland Drive in detail would be very difficult.
Right.
I mean, I could tell somebody about this, but at the end of it, I'm still pretty confused. I guess what I'm most confused about is, from a scholarly standpoint, does this have merit? Does this, and it must, because the Library of Congress chose this movie to be part of the historical archive of film, or whatever the fuck they call that. I guess that's the sense I'm trying to get from you, is like, okay, we know that this genre exists of just unsettling films that maybe do or don't mean anything, but that's not really the point. The point is to unsettle you. But what's the scholarly view of this that would cause the Library of Congress to pick this film out of any number of others to be kind of archived in such a way?
Well, first of all, I mean, let's look at the little monster. He's so adorable. They are so adorable.
Until it's like they take that wrapping off. They are very adorable.
Well, that's like opening a diaper, isn't it? That's kind of the way I looked at it, that whole unswaddling scene. But I thought it also, the unswaddling scene was that kind of thing, like when you get a newborn. It's kind of fitting because my son is getting ready to have his first child, so we're going through this. But been through that with three kids. They wrap that sucker so tight.
Yeah, in a swaddling master.
Yeah, exactly. And so you always got to keep the baby.
Yeah, exactly. Get him in there.
So when you see the baby wrapped up like this, that's definitely a metaphor for that, like it's holding its guts in. So when he goes and he cuts the cloth, he shouldn't do that because that's wrong. So I think that's kind of, that one was kind of an easy figure. For me, it was this film. Now, to answer your question about why, people that love David Lynch cite this as like his groundbreaking movie, maybe not his masterpiece. A lot of people consider that to be Mulholland Drive, maybe his masterpiece, or Elephant Man. But this is considered to be his breakthrough, where he made people notice him as a director. And the people that were in that art scene, in that art movie scene, he put himself right up there right away, you know, putting him in the same words of Fellini, who does a lot of interpretive, metaphoric, surrealistic films. So I think that, and that's definitely what this is. I think that, like we've talked about with Lynch and other films, I don't think even he knows what some of these metaphors are. It's, you know, actually, let's look at what Mike Florida said. He says, it feels like a dream from someone about to be a parent, and it was just weird for the art of it. And that's kind of, yeah, there's a lot of dream sequences. The scene in the factory where he falls asleep and his head falls off, or he goes into the radiator and has the dance with the girl with the big cheeks, and then eventually his head falls off, and then he ends up being made into an actual eraser, which is it. So it's all just about his mortality and what is he good for. And you can look at it however you want. I think the main goal is to, number one, is like Mike said just right there, the fear of being a parent. Not just about to become a parent, but just when you have that first kid, the paranoia that can run through, you know, his wife just gives up and goes back to her family. Sometimes that happens. And this guy's trying to make a go of it. And he's got this little thing that he's in.
Fucking nightmare, baby.
And it won't stop crying.
And it won't stop crying. Yes. I mean, parenting, like, it's wild when you go to a hospital because you're there for a baby to be delivered, yeah, but you're surrounded by like fucking terrible shit's happening in that hospital. Like, you know, the same time your baby's being born, someone's fucking dying, you know, and
it's a circle of life
thing in there. Yeah. I mean, you know, Lion King did a great job of describing that.
Exactly.
But like, so, I mean, I get that. Yeah. And like you said, the uncertainty and the, you know, self-judgment that you do, especially as a first-time parent, but you know, no matter how many kids you have, and are you doing it right, and all this stuff. And so, I mean, yeah, I get that. I guess I'd also wished that if you're going to, because he did take great care in Act One to kind of establish that we're living in some sort of post-industrial or not a post-apocalyptic, but you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. But like, why? I don't know that that added to the story for me to set it. It seems like if you're going to take the care to set it that way, then that's got to mean something.
Yes.
And when it doesn't, I felt a little let down, because I think at some point I kind of expected it to feel like that paid off, and the guy in the window wasn't enough of a payoff for me, I guess. I don't know.
And that one, it's all, you know, was starting off with the guy. I mean, he was, I don't know, steel worker, what, I don't know what he represented. He pulls the levers that makes the machines go. He's covered in sores. I think, I mean, again, it's very up to interpretation. And I'm sure that if we did digging, you could find people's opinions on this film. I think that what I tried to do was the things that, which is rare for me, the things I didn't understand, like this guy here, I just let go and kind of went, well, what's that mood setting? And I think it was orchestrating the machines of the inner workings of man, or because it comes into play at the end. We see him again when I believe that Henry, the Eraserhead, ends up dying ultimately because his child, who grows to be massive size, spoiler alert, and I think replaces him, like our children all replace us. And it doesn't mean Henry died right then and there. It means that he's going to die. His death is imminent. You know, they even have the scene where the girl with the big cheeks says, you know, hey, you know, everybody has their own little bit of heaven. So it kind of, you know, shows that that's where he's going. So I think with the machine guy, it was like what it is. I think with the industrial stuff, I think it is, to me, it was more simplistic as just being a representative of the working man, of kind of like the workers in a maybe a communal or socialistic type of environment where he just, that's all he does, that's all he knows, and he just happens to be on vacation when all of this happens. But normally his life is filled with work. So
they this as a device to like strip people of personality, you know, so you set it in this type of environment so that everyone is kind of marching to work and marching home and taking pills for their meals. You know, there's no sense of uniqueness or personality. So, I mean, maybe that, I mean, I guess you touch on that and I suppose that makes sense, you know, because he is really a pretty dull character. You know, he's not excitable. He's
very basic. Of,
very basic guy, kind of spineless. And so I mean, look, it's look, listen to me. You know, it's just a confusing one to try to put together, because it doesn't really mean anything, right? So if you're, and I think it just depends on like, what are you trying to get out of watching a movie? I mean, you and I have to get out of it some, enough of something for us to discuss it every other week.
Yeah.
Some people who are more, you know, scholarly or studied, you know, will watch films differently than the general public. And that's, so it's whatever you're trying to get out of it. I guess I think to the average person, which I am squarely, you know, in the average person category, it's just kind of a spectacle. You know, I don't know what I expected. I really don't know if this is a good movie or not. and maybe a 7.3 out of 10 on IMDb speaks to that as, like, a lot of people don't know if this is a good movie or not, or opinion is just strongly divided between the tens and the fives. You know, I don't know what the case is, but it just was like, at least I saw it. I felt like, you know, I made it all the way through it. It was fucking weird. Just like the first time I had sex. Glad I did it.
But you got to the end. Maybe got a little head there.
Yeah, got a little head. Came too early. And
for those
that was just kind of it.
For those of you just listening, there's an image of Henry's head on the floor. That's why we said that. So that joke doesn't work if you're just listening to the podcast. So always make sure to
podcast. Good thing podcasts are a visual medium for us to work with.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, for those that are just listening, we want to thank you for coming back and welcome to Box Office Battles with Greg and Eric. We're talking about Eraserhead in our David Lynch best battles. We're getting close to our final four tonight, Eraserhead versus Straight Story. But yeah, thank you for tuning in. You can always reach us on email at boxofficebattles.com. You can find us on Twitch at Box Office Battle Pod if you want to watch the Twitch live stream, or you can do YouTube at Box Office Battle Podcast to watch our live stream each and every other week that we try to do it. This is our season finale. We are going to be taking a quick break only for about a month or so till we retool and start up again at the end of May. Yeah, so it's one of those things like with Eraserhead. So my thing is, when it was over, and now I really watched it more than I did back then. I remember when I watched it, to be honest with you, I was shaken to the point where, all right, what the heck was that? For me, I thought as a teenager, all right, I'm not qualified to understand that film. But that being said, I had watched The Wall a few times and Heavy Metal and other films that were cult films. And The Wall, is cryptic as it can be, made total sense to me as a teenager. It's very symbolic. It's surreal at times, but it makes perfect sense to me. I've watched it a million times, and I could explain The Wall to you in 15 minutes or less. But yeah, with this, I walked out and I went, no, it just isn't right. And a few of the guys I with snuck into another film because they were like, F that movie. That movie's stupid as shit. They had nothing to do with it. But
are these your two binary experiences with Eraserhead? Was like 1986 and then now for the podcast? Now. Or have you seen it in between?
No, I never watched it again after that.
Okay, well, then that's a pretty interesting viewpoint right then.
Yeah, I remember getting a book because, being a movie buff, I think I subscribed to Entertainment Weekly in the 90s, and you got a book that was the 100 greatest the 100 back when magazines were a thing. They were the 100 greatest movies ever made, and I was like, cool, I really want to, I want to go through this. I want to watch all 100 greatest movies ever made. That was one of my goals. I don't think I ever did in that book. But Eraserhead was like number 20 out of 100. And this is in like 95. And I remember seeing that and going, no, it was interesting. Now, that all being said, watching it now, I watched it at night with lights out in the living room, and it was horrific. And even though it's not a slasher film, it's not zombie film, it's just very unsettling. The baby getting sick, which again, it's meant to be that way. It's representative. That one you can relate to as a parent. It's representative of our children getting an illness and we can't do anything about it. And it's gross. You've got all these bodily fluids and things going around.
Fucking A, dude.
and so Henry has to deal with it. And he does. He takes care of it best he can. He takes care of the baby so well. When he cuts the swaddling clothes and all the guts spill out, it ends up growing into itself. He does his job ushering that baby into adulthood, or whatever you want to call it. There's the dream sequence where he's in the theater and his head falls off and the baby's head, the alien baby's head, takes over. Again, representative of the baby taking his place, I think. I mean, I'm just
the baby in all of us.
The baby in all of us inside. I don't know if the baby was actually inside of him. But there's a lot of things like that. It's they having sex with the woman next door, whether she was a prostitute, I believe she was, and they go into the bed full of fluid, which, I mean, we kind of all could figure that one out if we wanted to, and he kind of drowns in the fluid. A lot of bodily fluid.
Which is hot.
Yeah. I.
But didn't contribute to the plot at all.
No, but it was interesting.
Do people own water beds anymore, Greg? No. I'm talking those big box frame, like big fucking 4,000 pound water beds. Like, do they make, could you, can you buy a water bed today? Like that?
I don't know. I think you would, if you did, you would have to like specialty order that shit from like Temu or something.
Signing a lease for an apartment, and they're like, if you're on the second floor, you can't have a waterbed, you know, because they like weigh too much and it's a risk or hazard or something.
Yeah.
But like, I haven't seen a waterbed in.
I had a waterbed.
30 years.
I had a waterbed.
I would have a fucking waterbed.
I did. When I graduated and I got my own place.
Yeah.
I literally
waterbed owner.
I went to Rent-A-Center and decked out my house with all. I was scammed. That was horrible. I was paying
9,000% interest.
Oh, Lord. Well, it was basically I wasn't going to pay for any of it, you know, just making the monthly payments or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I got a waterbed, and at first it was great. But one thing they don't tell you about waterbeds is that the water evaporates slowly, and then you have to continually fill it up, which is a pain in the ass. But if you don't, you get air bubbles in it so that when you move, it sloshes like really loudly, and good Lord. It was not a good thing. It would drive you insane. And so you'd barely move and slosh, 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 slosh. And I couldn't do it. And then they give this impression of having sex on a waterbed is erotic. It's not. It is one of the most challenging things that you'll probably ever do in your life. It's like being in a bounce house trying to do something like that, where you can't get any footing. You can't get
Already like super uncoordinated and like not good at it. And so now I got this whole other fucking thing to deal with.
You got shit. Just a one bad wave and you're thrown. You're in, and you probably injure yourself. So yeah,
can buy a waterbed on like.
Oh, really? Are you looking it up? That's nice.
$1,500.
Good look. It's yeah.
And what? Like with the old like wood, like paneling, yeah. Like frame.
Yeah. Yeah, that's how it works. I eventually got rid of the bladder, the water piece, and I just put a mattress in the frame, and problem solved. And then I was much happier.
This is waveless, it says.
Well, they may have better technology now. This was in the late 80s, early 90s, so they may have better technology.
That's what I mean. Like, the technology's better, but nobody wants a fucking waterbed.
Why would you get a waterbed that was waveless? What's the point of having a wave?
I don't know. That's just
called
a mattress, right?
That makes no sense.
Well, anyway, I don't know if...
Yes.
Henry from Eraserhead,
no.
If they were in a waterbed or if it was semen.
Disgusting fluids. I knew a girl like that in high school once, and that's what it reminded me of.
Be nice to that. That's somebody's somebody.
I wasn't going to mention her by name.
Well, I don't. She knows who she is.
Yeah, well.
Disgusting old bitch.
Anyway, there's the baby when it turned into a giant baby, and I think ate him. I don't know.
Yeah,
it ate him.
All right, so that's Eraserhead.
That's Eraserhead.
It was weird. It was whatever, but it was better than this next film.
Okay. All right, now, we talked about this a little offline, but...
You want to fight me?
No, I don't want to fight you over it. It was funny. I was surprised.
Caddyshack me?
No, I'm not going to caddyshack. I'm not going to get mad. I don't care. I Caddyshack to me, when we had a dispute over that, whether it was good or not, that was a movie that I kind of hold near and dear to my heart. This one I just liked. I've watched it twice. I had to watch it when I was in school, and I appreciated it then. And this time, this one, my wife actually watched with me all the way through, and she loved it too. She was talking about it. So we're talking about The Straight Story,
what
which is
talk about. Okay, go ahead. Then you've got the floor. Tell me all the great things about this boring ass Disney piece of shit.
Well,
listen, there is no audience for this movie.
I think it's because you were in pain or
I watched this before.
I think this is what gave you a kidney stone.
It might be. But why is there? What is the market for a G-rated film that children will not watch? Because I could set all three of my kids, 16, 10, 6, down and say, let's pull up Disney Plus. Let's watch the G-rated The Straight Story. there's not one of those kids that's going to make it through 10 minutes of this bullshit.
That is true.
I hardly made it through it.
That's true.
And I understand that children's movies have changed. Everything's got to be like super jacked up, extreme cuts every five fucking seconds. It's disorienting, but kids these days, you know, can't pay attention for whatever. Yeah. So I get that the pacing's going to be different, but there's no market for a G-rated movie that only adults will watch.
Are you saying there's no market about a true story about a man who rode his riding lawnmower 400 miles across state lines to see his dying brother who had not spoken to in years because of a fall? There's no market for that. That's what you're telling me.
That is what I'm telling. That is what I'm telling.
I think you're 1,000%.
Wrong. 1,000%.
The people who watch Hee Haw probably love this movie. And
are
I watch
one of those people, Greg?
Yeah, I like Hee Haw. I ain't gonna lie.
I like some of the musical stuff from Hee Haw, for sure.
I like the skits. I like the...
You like Minnie Pearl.
No, what was the blonde with the farmer daughter one? I can't remember her name.
I don't remember either.
I don't remember their names.
I just felt like my grandma liked Hee Haw, and she'd probably like the straight story, too.
I guarantee you there's a lot of people who would. Yeah, middle America would enjoy this story. I think it's done well. Critics adored it. I mean, what's the IMDb rating on it? It is
8.
8 out of 10.
It's fucking crazy. This is
so what I'm saying is that critics liked it. Now, we can talk about critics or not. Actually, 8 out of 10 is the audience rate. So that's most people that on IMDb really loved the film. A Metascore of 86. An average of 86 out of 100 critics love this film. It's this just like you. You don't like good things. You don't like good things.
Cinema is a really nice study of like race relations in America, the fucking Blind Side. Like, it's for people dull enough to think that movie had anything important to say.
At the time, this is
the movie for you.
At the time, the Blind Side was like one of those things. It did really well. I mean, people did like it. It's
such a bullshit story and a bullshit movie, as is the straight
story.
Well,
it is a true story.
I would watch a documentary about this guy.
No, that would be boring.
They were like, no, you're boring. I said I don't want to fight, and I don't.
The true story of Alvin Strait wasn't as good. They definitely embellished it. So one of the things that I thought made it really, really work. So here's the thing that I marveled at watching it the second time, and especially watching it doing all of these David Lynch films. So I will point this out right off the bat. This is an image we have on the screen of the next door neighbor lady doing her tan, eating her, coconut balls. What are they called? Snowballs. Snowballs, because that's what Woody Harrelson hates in Zombieland. But anyway, so she's sitting out there, and Alvin has a stroke. Now, parallel, let's flash back to one of the first movies we covered, Blue Velvet. Similar type of situation, similar type of scene. In Blue Velvet, David Lynch takes Americana and shows this beautiful image, similar to the one we have on screen right now, before Alvin has a stroke. What happens in Blue Velvet? The guy is watering his lawn, and he has a stroke. Goes into the hospital, and Kyle MacLachlan has to go, you know, it starts the movie. But in Blue Velvet, you see this dark underbelly of Americana that is seemingly, you know, that beyond like every small town, there's no good people. There's all full of secrets and lies. Everybody's got something they're hiding. With the straight story, what David Lynch did is he gave us the same imagery, but by contrast, there isn't an evil dark side to anyone in this town. Even this bitch, she's fine. I mean, she's a little conceited, a little full of herself, but there's no insidious plot. He plays it to the level. And that's, to me, was wild, because you know who the director is, and he still throws in those kind of odd characters. But,
oh, you mean like Sissy Spacek pretending to have some unspecified mental deficiency?
She's slow.
Whatever.
She's slow.
Oh, that's
that's what they say.
Medical.
She's slow, Eric. She's slow. She's just slow.
In bumfuck, you know, wherever this movie starts from, that is what they say, you know, if not worse. So,
well, yeah, I mean,
you don't want a little conflict. You don't want a little dark side. You don't want a little, your favorite movie is Empire Strikes Back. That movie's all about a little bit of dark side. This movie doesn't have anything.
Well, there is like, the challenge is the journey, being able to make the journey. The dark side is him against the environment, him against the road.
No, it's him being a dumb fuck who, in of all of the modes of transportation available, decided he was going to take a tractor.
He couldn't drive. He couldn't get a license. He couldn't see.
Would you like to know what I would do if I couldn't drive somewhere?
What?
Not take a tractor.
What would you do? So this,
I mean,
this came
call
up
an Uber.
This exactly. This came up when my wife and I were watching. She's like, "Why can't his daughter take him?" I said, "Well, she's a little slow. Why can't anybody in the town take him?" Well, nobody in the town took him. The goal was for him to do a gesture, to do it on his own, because he owed his brother, you know, to reconcile with him. He wanted to get there on his own and show his brother how much he loved him and what he was willing to do to get them. That's why he always says, even at the end, when we're jumping ahead, but anyway, when the really nice guy lets him stay outside in his tent and the guy offers to take him the rest of the way, he's like, this is what he had to do. And so that's the mission and the purpose. Another thing I wanted to point out about Lynch's approach to this film that I thought was really, really interesting, and a lot of people don't pick up on, there are a lot of people he encounters along the way as he's doing this journey. He leaves the town. It, you know, we won't get into the fact where he has to shoot the tractor, which I thought was great. And then he's wandering around with the semis. I told my wife, when we were in Tokyo, we rode go-karts through the streets of Tokyo, and we had semis like right alongside us. I'm like, that's what I felt like riding those damn go-karts right next to a semi was the scene here. But anyway, he, you know, he goes through all this, but then he meets these people along the way. It's very a love song.
Schmaltzy.
It's a love song to Middle America. You get a lot of sweeping shots of cornfields and small town roads, but examine the progress that he makes with everybody along the way. So I'm going to point out all the people he meets along the way. He meets the hitchhiker first. She is pregnant. So you have a baby and a young woman. The next people that he meets are the bikers, I believe, was the next one. They were like in their early 20s or whatever. Then he meets the middle-aged woman with the deer, which I thought was a hilarious scene because we were talking about having to go back from teleworking. I'm like, see, if she was teleworking, she wouldn't have hit a freaking deer every day. But anyway, she hits the deer all the time, back and forth to work, a little bit older. So as you go through the movie, he makes these progressions. There's the ones with the bikers that he ends up meeting, the bicyclist, I guess. And eventually he meets the you know, 50-year-old man and then his father, who is an older man. And then he, at the end of all of that, he meets the priest who kind of gives him the consolation and, again, kind of wishes him well along the way. Intentional or no, I think with Lynch, I think we know things, a lot of things are intentional. The progression of age is a symbolism of life to death. It's a journey of life to death. Baby, young woman, early 20s, middle age, later life, old age, and then eventually heaven. It's a
theme so easy to spot that Ray Charles could have seen it.
It's a good theme, though.
But we have to act like this is groundbreaking stuff. Who I wish he would have met?
What, Satan?
Fucking semi head on.
Oh, jeez. I did like it.
Listen, what do you want me to do? You want me to watch this G-rated 1999 Disney movie and act like I was entertained by this, like, at all?
You don't have to agree with me. You can agree with the 86% of critics that loved it and the 80% of fans that love
86%
it.
86% of people on Earth like AIDS.
They do. They do.
Yeah. That's a study I recently saw that I am unable to reproduce for you at the moment. I don't know. I just, you know, what percentage of Germans were Nazis during World War II? You know, like more than 86%? Yeah, we got to act like they were all right, you know?
I don't know. 86% is a bit high.
I have the courage to say they were not. But
comparing this movie, the fans of this movie, to Nazis, that's a whole new one. That's good.
I think everybody who likes this movie is a literal Nazi, yeah. Although the two can't be proven to be mutually inexclusive. I just think... I don't know. And I'm not like some guy that needs to be like hyper entertained at all times. You know, yeah. I like movies that are just, you know, there and don't require a whole lot of me. And in fact, I probably prefer that, if I'm being honest, because kind of like we talked about as we started this David Lynch thing, like I'm not the kind of person who has the time or really the brain power to like think about stuff like this all the time. And I don't know that I seek out challenges within movies, right?
Right.
Or, you know, films, whatever. No, you cannot see my sources. it was just something I saw. But so like, it's not like I'm not a prime candidate for enjoying something like this. It was just... I mean,
you just didn't enjoy it. You thought it was boring.
I didn't enjoy it. And I felt like it was formulaic and I felt like it didn't offer anything more than any other, like trying to make amends, going on a trip to prove, you know, making it harder on yourself just because you think that makes your journey more valuable. You know, all of these things that I'm like, man, I don't buy that. You know, making things unnecessarily hard on yourself is not a virtue. It's like dumb. Just do things the way, the easy way. Yeah. Just take a taxi. Go see your dying brother. He had a stroke. He doesn't give a shit that you hopped on a tractor. You know, he just.
But like, he does.
When I have a stroke and die, which I hope is soon, I hope it's before I have to watch this piece of shit again. I hope that my kids just take whatever means will get them to me with the least amount of complications for them as quickly as they can get to me. You know, gotcha. I don't need them on a tractor. I don't need them taking a fucking submarine or like hot air ballooning their way across the North Atlantic or anything. Just get on a fucking airplane and come see me before I lose all of my capacities.
I hear you. I will say this, first of all, is it for me, the film, I don't look at it as being overly formulaic. I look at it as very sweet. I look at it as something we watched it on a Saturday afternoon. And it was just nice to have on. It wasn't compared to all the new shit. We've tried to watch a lot of new movies lately. Maybe in season two, I'll discuss them. But good Lord, it seems like everything we put on, and maybe I'm just the old man shaking his fist at the sky, but good Lord, there's some shitty movies out there. And we put this on and it was just nice. And my wife and I just enjoyed an afternoon of something being nice and funny at times, pleasant, decent story. The journey was fun to watch. And then for me, like I said, I've watched being child of I have five brothers and sisters, so a family of six kids, and we've had our falling ins and outs. And there was one time where two of my brothers didn't speak for like 3 years, and right now I'm not speaking to my older sister, and I'm not going to get into why, but we have not spoken in, this will be 4 years, and I have no desire to speak to her right now. She sent me a Christmas card this last year and I went, oh, that's nice. I that's not going to cut it for me. However, if she showed up on a riding lawnmower into my house, because if she just drove up into my driveway, I wouldn't let her in. I would. Okay. I'd be like, screw you. You that just coming to see me means nothing. But I tell you what, if she were to show up on a riding lawnmower, I'd hear her out. I'd be like, all right, you've earned my attention. You've earned my attention. She does. So let's look at the clip. Let's look at the clip real quick, because Harry Dean Stanton plays his brother, and it's the climactic moment of the film where he gets there. I saw somebody in one of the fan reviews say that Harry Dean Stanton to them was like the Darth Maul of this movie. He's only in it for a short time, but man, that dude is awesome, and he just makes an impact. And I feel the same way. I love Harry Dean Stanton. Loved him in Escape from New York. Love him just about anything I see. So what I'm going to do is play this clip real quick of the final scene where he shows up in the lawnmower and the impact that it has on his brother. And that's looking at the lawnmower. Look at it. What the heck?
I feel the same way. I feel the same way, bro.
But look at his face. Oh, he knows.
He's mad.
No, he this. Ride that thing all the way out here to
see me. See, he's pissed. Instead of taking an airplane.
I did, Lyle.
See, in his face, the gesture that it made. Everything. There's nothing more needs to be said.
He's a good actor. Yeah. I mean, okay. And I don't know if you know this about filmmaking, but they told him to act that way for this movie. But it doesn't mean that he really felt that way.
Oh, my goodness.
It doesn't mean that the brother in real life felt that way. The brother in real life may have been like you and your sister, and he was like, dude, fuck off forever. You don't get to show up here on a fucking tractor.
Well, okay, so I give you that. But to me, I really like that scene, because you know, it's just impact, that the fact that it meant so much to him, then it all makes sense.
And I can appreciate that you had a pleasant experience watching this with your wife.
Yes.
And I agree with you, in a world where media is kind of shit, because you know it's just to make money, and we don't get a whole lot of like passion projects that it doesn't seem to like that anyway. And I get that life in general is stressful, or, you know, I haven't been feeling well for a week, and it's not just the Stones. It's like the painkillers screw up your stomach. You know, it's just like, I get that all of that stuff can be going on, and you just need something that you can put on, relate to or not, but that you and your wife got to do that. I appreciate that. Yeah. I just like this, and right. And so my experience isn't the same as yours.
Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with
that. Like I always do, and watch this. And I just kept going. I mean, my original statement stands. It's like, who's this movie made for? I mean, who the Venn diagram of people who would be interested in a story like this, but also it needs to be G-rated Disney, you know?
Yeah,
slop.
I don't know about the G rating
fucking thing.
Yeah, I don't know about the G rating. It needed that. I think it's just the fact that David Lynch did it. I heard the story like when they were at Cannes the year this was coming out, and they announced that next year Cannes was going to have a Disney film rated G by David Lynch, and the crowd erupted in laughter because they thought it was a joke. And maybe it was one of those things where Lynch was like, I'm going to prove that I can do a film like this. And I think that it goes against
anybody could.
All right. But anyway, it goes like we're comparing it and contrasting it with Eraserhead, which couldn't be, I mean, from the same director, these two films couldn't be more different in their approaches to storytelling. You don't have any symbolism in the straight story. It's a straight story, and it's fascinating that Lynch could do it. Now, that all being said, I don't know that it's a go-to movie for me. I wouldn't say it's in my top 1,000 movies. I just enjoyed it. There's a lot of movies that I could put on from the 80s or 90s. Shit, after-school specials with frickin' Ricky Schroeder I could put on and just have a, you know, pleasant 90 minutes of whatever. Hallmark movies for whatever. My wife doesn't really watch those, but my aunt does, so occasionally I'm over there, she's got one on, and then I'll get sucked into one of those things. But anyway, then that's all this is to me. It's not anything special. It's not an Oscar winner. It's not, you know, although Sissy Spacek's performance, come on. I mean, next to Simple Jack, she does a phenomenal.
The most insulting thing I've ever seen in my life.
Although I did choke up when she sees the boy with the ball. And you're like, what's that all about? And then you find out later that her kids were taken away from her. So, and I was kind of like,
from Mac and Me was more convincing as an alien than she was as a person with some sort of like mental defect or disability. I don't know if you're allowed to say it's a defect, but whatever.
Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I mean, I don't know. Just.
Well, I was going to show this last thing about the movie. If you didn't know, if you weren't paying attention, the two brothers that work on his tractor or lawnmower, riding lawnmower, are Chris Farley's brothers.
Yeah.
In real life. So they played brothers in real life. They both were Chris Farley's brothers and they were in this. And I thought it was, I love Chris Farley. So seeing the two brothers in there, I thought that was kind of cool.
Was Chris Farley dead at this point?
99? I believe so.
99. I don't know.
I cannot confirm or deny that, but I think he was. If not,
we know for a fact he was not.
He was dead. He was dead when I watched the movie. I know that for a fact.
Yeah, for sure.
Because I just watched it a couple weeks ago.
Yeah. He'd been dead for many years.
Yeah. So I'm just saying. I think he was. But anyway. So
I always go first on these things. You tell me what's going on.
Well, Greg. You know, Mike has a comment. One of our regular listeners, for those who listen to the podcast, Mike, I can never say his last name. Leblanovitz.
Leblanovitz.
Is that
he doesn't want you saying that anyway.
Oh, sorry. He didn't say that.
Edit that out.
Okay, I will. Mike Florida, which is his handle.
Edit it out. With like silence, edit it out with like an actual beep. So it sounds like Mike Dickhead or whatever. But beep.
That would be good. I'll do that on the podcast. Mike, you can check that out. We'll beep it out. But his comment here, I saw it pop up and I have to agree with this. You know, this film, The Straight Story, shows his range between that, but Eraserhead's way more thought provoking. And there he goes. He's explaining. It's Leblanovitz. It doesn't matter anymore. but that's kind of how I feel about these two films is that, you know, and we were discussing over text real quick today. I was like, you know what? The thing that I have to say about Eraserhead is that it's iconic. The Straight Story, if you say David Lynch, now I like The Straight Story, you don't. So this makes this kind of easy. But if you say to somebody, what's your favorite David Lynch film? To somebody, a group of David Lynch fans. I don't think, maybe 1 out of 100 would say The Straight Story.
Yeah, no shit.
But I would say at least 20 of them, if not more, would say Eraserhead. Some would say The Elephant Man. Some would say Blue Velvet. Lost Highway would be in there. And definitely Mulholland Drive would be up there. So I think when you're grading these two against each other, you got to go with what is, as far as what's more Lynchian, what makes more sense. And it is considered one of the best films ever made. You know, it was in my book. It was in my book of the 100 greatest. So I would say Eraserhead for me, and I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not like this was some sort of landslide or anything. I'm kind of like, I didn't like either one of these movies, if I'm being honest, for different reasons, for very different reasons. But like, at least one of them was interesting, and that's Eraserhead.
It is interesting.
At least I thought about it again after I watched it. At least it provoked something in me, even if that thing that was provoked was not something I particularly enjoyed. At least it was something. Just give me something. Yeah. Like the worst hand job you've ever got in your whole life. like, is better than not getting a hand job.
That's true.
So that's what these movies were like. Like, you know,
unless the hand job was done with somebody holding broken glass, then that would not be, that would be pretty bad.
That would be watching the street
story. Okay. I don't think it's that bad. No, I like
this. Okay, it's not that bad, but
so Eraserhead, the one thing I will say as far as me is that it can be nonsensical, but it's so unsettling that it stays with you. I don't think I'll forget it. That's one thing that I'll say about this film. I don't know if I will watch it again, but I think that it just stays with you and I'll never forget it. And so, like, unlike, like, for me, like some of the others that we've watched, I would watch a few of these again, just again to pick them apart, enjoy the performances. But Eraserhead, I might watch it down the road. I don't know if I'd ever tell anybody to watch it. I told my wife, don't go near this thing, because she would question my own sanity as to why I was watching this film. So, well, that brings us to the final four. And like I said, this is a double episode. So what we're going to do right now is we are going to go right into the finals of David Lynch's best films. And we've got there. We've got four remaining. Eraserhead is going to go up against Mulholland Drive, and Elephant Man will go up against Lost Highway from our very first round. So without any further ado, I mean, look at this. I mean, these are good films. So I think we've enjoyed them. Now, like I said, you didn't like Eraserhead all that much, but I think outside of like Ted, who was a guest on the show a while back, he kind of liked Blue Velvet over Lost Highway, but I still think this is a pretty good final four of David Lynch films.
Okay, what's crazy is, like, these three, but outside of Eraserhead that we just talked about,
yeah,
were unanimous. We didn't have to go back and forth on these. And so not only were they unanimous and we liked them a lot, we talked about all the reasons why on those episodes, but even just looking at this, I already know on each side of the bracket, and I know the winner, which is interesting.
Okay. Well, your winner.
My winner. Yeah. I can't speak to yours.
If we don't agree, it could be a first season cliffhanger, like Who Shot JR, where we can't reveal we can't reveal the winner until the next season starts, and that could happen. So,
I mean, that could happen. I get the sense it's not going to, but we will okay. find out.
Well, let's start with our number one seed, The Elephant Man. Great film against Lost Highway that we both, I mean, really, really enjoyed. I mean, that beat out Blue Velvet, which is considered one of his best. I think we picked Lost Highway because it was not as dark, and it was more thought-provoking in a way. It was definitely messed with your head a lot more. It was definitely like a captivating type film.
They were like the same style of film. That was a fun episode to do because the movies were similar, but just like you said, we liked the tone of Lost Highway better than, I mean, you want to talk about disturbing. Blue Velvet has some,
it's dark,
pretty gnarly scenes, not just like Eraserhead where they're off-putting.
Yeah.
But really, and I'm not one of these people, but like, if you want to say trigger warning, this movie's got them. I mean, in bunches of things that if you're not prepared for them can kind of put you in a weird place. Right. So I liked, you know, I liked Lost Highway. But putting it up against Elephant Man is kind of like putting Eraserhead up against The Straight Story, not in the joking, haha, I didn't like Straight Story, but in that one of them is told very linear.
Right.
It is not what we have called unreliable narrator. It's not mixed up timelines. It's not characters kind of blurring into and out of one another. Elephant Man doesn't really require that you have some sort of either outside knowledge like the Twin Peaks movie did, or chalking things up to mysticism like some of the movies. I mean, it's just told in kind of a traditional movie way, a narrative movie way. So how are you going to look at the disparity between those two styles of movies and how are you going to figure out your winner for that side of the bracket?
Well, this one is tough from the standpoint of, we've discussed before, you know, like normally when we do these, it's like, all right, which one would I rather watch again? Which one do I want to consume as entertainment again? Which one, that to me tells you which is the better of the film. But in this case, where we're talking about Lynch films, Lost Highway, Eraserhead, Mulholland Drive are true Lynch films. These are films that he, you know, had a hand in writing, and he directed them. They were his visions. Elephant Man is too, as well, to an extent. He does a few of the things he normally does, but he plays it fairly straight in The Elephant Man. But, you know, like what I like about Lost Highway is all of that surreal atmosphere. I really enjoy the way it messes with your head when he jumps, you know, into the younger body, the Baltazar Getty character, when Bill Pullman makes that transformation and you have to figure out what the hell is going on. And so I like that, being able to uncover that mystery, and that's a true Lynchian fashion. And I like the soundtrack. There's a lot that I love about Lost Highway. Now, I say all that to say this. Damn, I love me some Elephant Man. That movie, I still remember watching it recently. I hadn't watched it in years. It affected me on a very deep emotional level. Lynch, and so if we're going to give credit to the director, he had a major, major hand in that. It was one of those things that I, you know, just, you don't forget what it stirs in you. When you think about John Merrick and everything that he went through, I think it does that kind of impact with you, and it just stays with you because it's based on the true story. We talked a lot about the true story and how it made us feel as far as watching it and knowing that it's similar to the true story. It's similar enough to where it's impactful. Mm-hmm. You know, that this person had, I mean, imagine going through this and what you look like at that time is unreal. So especially with the medical care being what it was, we've been watching this show called The Food That Made America on the History Channel. It's really good, by the way. It talks about all these iconic food brands and things that came up. And one of the things they talk about when Heinz made his ketchup was all the food vendors in that pre-turn of the century, industrial age, post-Civil War, were putting dyes into milk to make it look whiter. They were putting copper into pickle jars to make them look greener. They were poisoning people. So many people had stomach cancer and stomach ailments. So that's just from normal, healthy people. And then you think about somebody like John Merrick, who has all of these illnesses and can't even get the care he needs to survive. And that's just, it's gut-wrenching. If you're a human being, as John Merrick says he is, your heart has to go out. Now, if you're an unfeeling, uncaring son of a bitch, then no, this definitely is not the movie for you. But yeah, I just, going back to when I watched it, it was very impactful. So
I agree with you. And we use that metric a lot. Which of these would I want to watch again? Or if I could only choose the one. That's an interesting way to frame this one for me, because I really would enjoy another crack at Lost Highway, because I've only seen it once and it has enough. I mean, A, it has enough rewatch value to want to watch it again, but B, it's got enough stuff that you probably don't pick up the first time that I don't even know that I would say it will make more sense if you watch it a second time, but you'll probably come away with, you know, little pieces of the story that make a little more sense to you.
Mm-hmm.
So in that regard, I would prefer to watch Lost Highway again. On the other hand, just like you said, the way that Elephant Man made me feel when I watched it, I mean, I could watch that movie 100 more times because it's comforting, and in times where it seems like no one gives a shit about anybody else, or in times where it seems like all of humanity is in conflict, here's a story that is enlightening, and it it affected me the same way it affected you, right? And yeah. the humanity and the empathy and just all of the good parts that can surround the human condition are on display in that movie. I think that's worth more to me than trying to figure out more about Lost Highway. I already like Lost Highway. I liked it. It was the winner unanimously. Mm-hmm. I liked it on its first watch. So if I had to choose one or the other, I do think that it's Elephant Man for this side of the bracket.
Yeah.
I mean, is that where you were going with yours?
For sure. For sure. Yeah. I choose Elephant Man for the main reason of the impact that it has. I like both films a lot. Again, I'd watch them both, especially what we've done during this whole bracket series. Uncovering certain things. I'd like another crack at it just to continue to explore that world, especially when we know it kind of connects to Mulholland Drive and Twin Peaks. And I'm still watching Twin Peaks again, so who knows? I may watch it again. But yeah, when you got to go with what is the best film of the two, it is without a doubt Elephant Man. It is, more people can enjoy it. It is gut-wrenching. It's uplifting. It's got everything. So I definitely would say that would be mine.
And not to mention, you know, if taken in a vacuum, we have to watch these movies with always a thought about what we're going to talk about, mm-hmm. you know, when you and I come together. But if you go to a movie, what is it that you want to be mm-hmm. as an audience member? Do you want to be entertained? Do you want to be thrilled? Do you want to be scared? You know, or sometimes do you just want to watch something that makes you feel great? And, you know, you can watch Lost Highway and it can make you feel some of those things. It's just not going to compare to, I think for 99% of people, it's not going to compare to how you felt sitting there watching Elephant Man. So I'm happy that we agree on that. I the way you started that, it kind of sounded like you were going Lost Highway, but
yeah, I didn't want to dismiss it because it's a very Lynchian film and it should be given credit where credit is due. But I think when you compare the two without and take David Lynch out of it, you can't compare them.
You're going to have your opportunity in about 30 seconds, you know what I'm saying.
So what you're saying is
a true Lynchian film, right?
Yeah. So what you're saying is in our second Final Four matchup, you pretty much got this down where you handled Eraserhead and you voted for it in the last round, but you're not going to vote for it this round.
Dude, I mean, Mulholland Drive was such an experience for me.
Yep.
For a lot of reasons, and I think the balance of the parts that I was really proud of myself for kind of immediately latching onto and understanding, and the parts that I wasn't quite sure of, the parts that you kind of explained to me as we got on here. But I will say this. I have thought about that movie a dozen times since I watched it, and since we had the episode where we discussed it, little things will pop up. I saw a meme on Reddit the other day that was a picture of the two ladies, and someone under it said, are they girlfriends? And the person commenting under said, oh no, it's worse. And I was like, yeah, like that's such a good, like a funny description of that relationship. Yeah. I mean, this is easy for me because I didn't like Eraserhead. So it's going up against Mulholland Drive. All I had to do was barely like Mulholland Drive for it to win against Eraserhead. And for me, it does.
Well, yeah. So we don't need to rehash Eraserhead. We've already talked about it, what we thought about it. It's just where it compares to Mulholland Drive. And this one, we know we did the episode. This one is a very meaningful film for me. I absolutely love watching it. I could watch it right now. There's some films in my life that have that distinction. You know, we've talked about it. Empire Strikes Back, Rio Bravo. I've watched those, you know, 50 times or more. There's other certain films that have that distinction where I never get tired of putting them on. The remake of Dawn of the Dead with the shopping mall thing, I could put that on anytime. Don't care. I'll put it on. Shaun of the Dead, I'll put on anytime. Don't care. And that's how Mulholland Drive is for me. Mulholland Drive is maybe even more special for that. It's because it's one of those films that to the average person, I'm not saying that I'm better than anybody else, it would be a little bit undecipherable if you don't take the time to pick it apart. A lot of people who go to the movies today, and like we talked about earlier, and need that quick release, you know, the quick action, not have to think too much, would despise this film. But I think it's one of the really few remnants of an era where you could make artistic films that were actually really enjoyable. Because compared to Eraserhead, which is artistic and has its moments that you can enjoy, I find Mulholland Drive artistic. But man, when you unlock the mystery, it's like your brain opens up and it's like, wow, I get this film. And then you rewatch it and you pick up on new things. And that's really special. Not every film can do that. When you're like, oh, I didn't even notice this before. I never heard them say this before. We talked about it in the episode where, you know, they're discussing it and the main character is like, it's just going to be just like in the movie. We'll pretend. And then you realize that's what they've been doing the whole time. So yeah, it's a fantastic film for me.
It's interesting that you say that about, you know, it's the kind of movie you could put on just like Shaun of the Dead or, you know, others, because, you know, typically when people say things like that, they're talking about either movies that they're really familiar with or mm-hmm. movies that aren't very challenging, so you don't have to be paying attention. So for you to say that about this film, which for a lot of people, and myself included, is challenging, more challenging than the average film, for mm-hmm. sure.
Yeah, for sure.
Really says a lot about, you know, kind of where this movie sits, you know, within, you know, your life, within your heart, you know, all of that stuff. And I mean, look, it's got Billy Ray Cyrus, so what more could you want?
I mean, that alone, you know. It's just a shame he didn't dance in it like he that meme.
I wish I could have seen the achy breaky, but I think the other thing is, you know, we have done a good job of going back to, because we chose 8 David Lynch films. These aren't 8 random films. No. They weren't 8 films that, you know, all had a twist or all had this or all had that. They were just 8 films directed by David Lynch. But the appreciation I'm sure that you get from multiple rewatches of Mulholland Drive is probably the same way I feel when I listen to, or when a lot of people listen to, Sgt. Pepper's, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the music is the music, and the music is really good, and especially for the time and for what was going on around them. But it gives you an appreciation for the people who made that art, you know, the Beatles for, you know, kids, you know, from Liverpool, singing skiffy songs and just kind of become the biggest thing in the world. You get that appreciation, and that they did it over like 7 years, I think, you know, from I Saw Her Standing There and Love Me Do. You know, like that's a big thing. All of that to say, just the appreciation that you get from that art that impacts you for the artist.
Right.
You know, and so I know for you that that's a big deal. I'm sure that we agree.
Yeah.
That Mulholland Drive wins over Eraserhead for sure.
I definitely agree that Mulholland Drive is the better of the film. I mean, I could talk about it all day, and that we don't need to do that because we've already have a whole episode where you can go back and listen to me talk about it all day. I love the film. Wrote a paper on it. It's an important film, I think, in cinema history. It's not for everybody, and I don't judge anybody that would say, "Oh, that movie sucks." I'd be like, "Yeah, that's fine. You have that opinion, but maybe you know." You know, you have your films and I have mine, because I like all kinds of films. I don't dismiss a film or ever say a film sucks based on that I didn't like it. I have to look at it. Well, what is so bad about it? And that's usually when somebody challenges me with a film that I really like, and I try not to take it personal. And I'll be like, well, what sucks about it? I didn't understand it. Oh, okay. Well, that's totally different then. It was too artsy for me, which is some people say, you know, some people they say now it's too woke or whatever. Okay. Well, now define where it was too artsy for you and what was the problem with it. And if that's the thing, it doesn't mean it sucks. It means you didn't like it because it was too artsy. It doesn't mean it sucks. So
yeah, I really can't imagine many people saying Mulholland Drive sucks.
Yeah.
I could for sure see people saying, I didn't get it, or I was confused, or only some parts of it made sense, but I was never able to put it all together. And I think that's fair and valid, but yeah, I can't imagine people saying just this sucked. 'Cause I think there's enough that you would get, even if you didn't get the whole thing, to make it a worthwhile, you know,
the biggest thing I've heard people that, you know, they'll say, oh, I really enjoyed it up until the last 40 minutes. And I'm like, well, that's the hook.
That's the movie.
That's the movie. If you just wanted them to wrap up the love story and that mystery, then that's a different movie. And that's not David Lynch. And it really wouldn't be as impactful. The fact that
you've got every right to stop watching at an hour 10.
Yeah.
Right after they finger bang each other, and
you could do that,
you know, then the movie makes perfect sense to you, and that's fine.
So
no one's make you watch the whole thing.
I mean, you could also just, you know, rewind that a few times and then continue to watch the rest of the movie. You don't have to.
You could
just, I mean, not saying that I've ever done that.
Sure.
I've never.
But one could, if one wanted.
Whatever happened to Laura Harring, either, the actress that plays Rita? I mean.
She died.
No.
Or her career did.
Oh. I was like, no.
I didn't mean to scare you.
I've not seen her in anything, but she's gorgeous. And yeah, and she plays the femme fatale so well. And the fact that, you know, you have this whole storyline where she rips Betty's heart out, and that's what the whole movie is about. I mean, it's basically, it ruined Betty's life. She wasn't able to, or Diane, you know, ruined her life.
Yes.
Because she wouldn't be able to do what she wanted to do, live the life she wanted to live, because she lost Rita or Camille. So yeah, it's fantastic. So yeah, so I think we agree that that is the winner of The Other Side of the Bracket. So we are down to our finals. And we're going to wrap this season up with...
Shit, dude, I knew that this was the way it was going to go.
Did you know?
Yes.
No, we did not discuss this beforehand, so that's a good thing. But here we are. We've got Elephant Man, our number one seed, versus our number three seed, Mulholland Drive. And that's just based on the IMDb ratings. Yeah, this is tough. You know, like the arguments I made about Lost Highway being Lynchian, but not having the impact that Elephant Man has. I can't say the same thing about Mulholland Drive, because to me that it's a perfectly written film, whereas Lost Highway has flaws in it that Elephant Man didn't have. I don't find those in Mulholland Drive for me. So I think that these two are really, 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 really on par, Elephant Man and Mulholland Drive, that is. I think that either one could easily win and be David Lynch's best film, according to us here at Box Office Battles. But we have to debate this, so you have to tell me what you think.
The merits we've discussed already, and they speak for themselves, and we can kind of, at this point in all of the brackets that we've done, you really start having to get really granular with your either praises or your critiques, because they got this far. You know, you remember we did this with, I think it was The Godfather and Singing in the Rain. Mm-hmm. And I was just, you know, so conflicted. And really the only problem with Singing in the Rain in that battle was that it wasn't The Godfather, you know, and that was it. Yeah. Elephant Man, as we've already discussed, is heartwarming It does all of the things that art is supposed to do, in my opinion, which is hit you and hit you in ways that make you feel or think or, you know, any of those things. If I had one criticism of Elephant Man, I think the pacing can be a little slow, I think, or maybe it was 15 minutes too long. You know, now I'd have to go back and rewatch to tell you what could be pulled out of that movie to correct that. Mm-hmm. Mulholland Drive is the only one of these eight films that I have consistently and recurringly thought about over the course of the last 2, 3, 4 weeks, however long it's been since we watched and then discussed that. There have been things that I'll just be working or doing dishes or folding laundry, and that movie will just randomly pop up into my bandwidth, you know, and I'm not necessarily trying to figure more of it out. I think you did a really good job of patiently, you know, kind of talking about the movie, a movie that was very important to you and that you're really passionate about. And it's just those kinds of little things when you get to, again, this point in our process that start to separate the movies. And so I think Elephant Man is a very, very worthy runner-up to Mulholland Drive. I think that's, of these eight David Lynch films, I think Mulholland Drive is the best movie. It's the best of these eight movies, in my opinion.
And that's really well said. I can take myself out of it when I look at these two films and kind of try to judge them without putting my own personal bias against it, which is very difficult. And I can look at Elephant Man, and it is an exceptional Oscar-worthy contender for Best Picture, Best Director. It has those type of qualities, and that when you watch one of those films, they're special to watch because they're crafted a certain way and they're set up a certain way to where they evoke all those emotional responses out of you. They do their job and they're unforgettable.
Really well said.
Yeah. I mean, like, look, you go through, you know, Unforgiven, Dances with Wolves, movies like that.
Driving this Daisy.
Yeah. And it's not like they're stereotypical or they're formulaic. But you know, when you're seeing one, because they have this quality about them. And when you put on The Elephant Man, it has that quality. Chariots of Fire is one that I really enjoy that has that quality. It's that historical aspect, the interesting characters, the really good dialogue, the way the story is crafted from A to B follows a really great progression. But Mike Flora just said Beetlejuice is the winner.
Please don't start me on that.
So if I were to judge it based on a craftiness of a film, I would, you know, say The Elephant Man is definitely, you know, you want to put them next to each other as far as Oscar contender. But Mulholland Drive was considered for Oscar contention. Didn't win anything. David Lynch, I think, should have won for it. And the thing about Mulholland Drive as just a film fan, if I'm taking Greg out and just looking at it from the side, it's not The Elephant Man. It's not the type of Oscar winner that wins. It's challenging. But it's also gut-wrenching on a different level. I go back to the scene where they see at this Club Silencio where the performer's singing Crying in Spanish, and it hits Diane, just everything. And it's just eruption of this emotion. It can't hide that agony that she feels. So it's one of those things where I think that film, it is not that conventional Oscar winner. It's not that polished film. And it's also not as difficult to consume as, say, a Blue Velvet or Lost Highway or any Eraserhead or any other David Lynch films. He gives you a good hour and 30 minutes of, that's what is, so he lulls you to sleep with this really sugary story.
Yeah, it was.
And he drops all of these hints. And then when you especially when you rewatch it. So taking it out of it, I would probably go, okay, maybe Elephant Man. But we're doing David Lynch's best films. And while The Elephant Man clearly is one of his best films, I really was impacted by The Elephant Man, made me emotional, did all those things that I talked about earlier as far as how it made me feel. Mulholland Drive, on the other hand, I got giddy when I watched it. I was also emotional in those scenes, but it was that uncovering that mystery, and I felt so like, wow, I get everything about this, and it makes so much more sense, and I really want to watch it again to get even more. And it just, it's a constant journey of a film. So without a doubt, putting myself back in it, I would say I could easily, if you'd argued Elephant Man, I could have gone, you know what? Mulholland Drive is just, maybe it's just for me, maybe it's just, but I think it's not. I think there's a lot of people, if you love film, you can love Mulholland Drive, especially if you dig into it. I think you really can.
I got good news for you.
Yeah.
Greg, this is your fucking show, so you don't have to take yourself out of it when you're talking about movies. I mean,
it's true.
It's us, yeah. You know, and it, so the people who listen,
yep,
want to listen because they want to listen to us talk about this stuff.
Yep.
So I think even more than you maybe think that you have a responsibility to take yourself out of it, I think the real responsibility is to put yourself into these, yeah, things. I mean, we are talking about the way these movies affect us, about the ways that they made us feel, about the ways that we consumed them and then understood them, because that's all you can do when you're watching a movie. I can't speak to somebody else's experience with either the movie as they saw it or their experience with the subject matter. You know, a movie about Mississippi burning, I certainly can be affected by the portrayals that I see in that movie, but I would not have the same reactions as someone who lived through civil rights in Mississippi in the 1950s and 60s, right? So
right.
I think we sell ourselves short when we kind of try to do that dancing around of, well, you know, even if I didn't think Mulholland Drive is the better movie, it's the better movie maybe because of some scholarly reason, academic reason, but it's the better movie because of the way it affected you and,
yeah,
similarly, the way it affected me. I mean, I just think that that's kind of the bottom line for both of us. So I'm glad that we did not have to end with a cliffhanger for another month. And I didn't want, you know, I'm not on Facebook, so if that's the way people vote for things, like, I wouldn't have known who was winning, what was going on. So I'm glad I don't have to wait a month to find out. So
yeah,
Greg, yep, the honors, huh?
Yeah. I mean, so again, if I'm putting myself in it without a doubt, I don't even have to think, I would say Mulholland Drive. So I had to take myself out of it just to be able to be, look at it from an unbiased, but I was never going to not root for Mulholland Drive. I could hear reasons why maybe the Elephant Man, but our clear winner. I mean, if you like David Lynch, if you love David Lynch, you definitely would pick Mulholland Drive. If you like David Lynch, you're probably going to pick Mulholland Drive. So it's definitely the winner of this battle. And so we've had a long journey on this one. It's been,
it's been very
interesting and fun. I've enjoyed it. I'm not going to lie.
I have too. And I got to say, Greg, I kind of knew going in, I was going to be challenged and I was going to rely on you a lot for context or just your experience with some of these films. And so I wanted to thank you for just the conversations that we've had, because yeah, this is a show and we would like it to be entertaining, but this is also just you and I talking about movies that we watched. And I appreciate your thoughtfulness and just, you know, the patience that you showed in, you know, kind of helping me to, yeah, understand some of what was going on in these things. I think I held my own really well. I was very anxious going into it. And I started to second guess myself on the David Lynch thing, because that was just a one-off conversation you and I had,
yeah,
by text message. It was like, fucking David Lynch died. You know, we should, you know, I think
you said
David Lynch movies. I think
you said,
and you were like, are you sure that's what you want to do?
Yeah, I think you said like, maybe we should do that. And I went, okay. You liked David Lynch when you said it. I thought you were like acknowledgeable. Hey, oh, Eric likes these. All right, well, then let's do it. Because I'm like, I can go down that rabbit hole if we want to. But I was like, are you sure?
I mean, this is a good, I mean, this show does a lot of things for me in a lot of different ways. every other week I get to talk to you, get to watch, you know, some movies that I might not otherwise see, be the center of attention for a little while, make people laugh, all of those different things. But it really is like the show will be more fun when we challenge ourselves to kind of get into stuff not as familiar with,
right?
Or get into things that make us uncomfortable, or, you know, just kind of, it'll be better when we do that. Now, this happened to be a category where you've got some pretty extensive, you know, kind of foundational knowledge. And so maybe this one wasn't as challenging for you, but there will be, as we work through some of these movies, that you really have to look at a different way, or you have to think about in a different way. So I think that's the fun part of doing this. And I think that is the fun part for me, for having done such a challenging set of movies. So I appreciate you, and it means a lot to me that you're willing to do that.
Well, I'm proud of you. I'm proud of what you did. And I know that you're an intelligent person and that you are going to get something out of these films. So I like doing stuff like this, and maybe we'll have another category like it down the road. I don't see us doing Fellini, but I see us maybe doing more challenging films in the future. So for all of us at Box Office Battles, I just want to say thank you so much for being with us on our first season. We really enjoyed all of our regular listeners. We really appreciate you guys being here each and every week to keep us company and to help us make decisions when we needed to. I want to thank Eric for our great first season. We're going to be back in about 6 weeks toward the end of May with Guilty Pleasures. And so keep your eye on the Facebook posts. So we're going to be asking you what your favorite Guilty Pleasures are. We want to hear from you. So we're looking forward to that. You can email us at boxofficebattles@gmail.com, and you can always subscribe at YouTube at Box Office Battle Podcast. So while we're saying that, I'm going to let Eric say goodbye for this first season of Box Office Battles.
You guys, thank you very much for tuning in. We appreciate you guys. And until the end of May, you guys be excellent to each other. We'll see you guys then.
It was a great first season, guys. Thanks so much.